From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. Seven Pacific nations have raised concern at a UN Human Rights Council on the human rights situation in Indonesia's Papua region or West Papua. Vanuatu's justice minister delivered a call at the current session of council in Geneva on behalf of his country and Tonga, Nauru, Palau, Tuvalu, Marshall Islands, and Solomon Islands. While it prompted a stern response from Indonesia, it's yet another sign of growing international advocation for West Papuan rights, as Johnny Blades explains to Jamie Tahanaha.
So Vanuatu's Justice Minister Ronald Worsall delivered this statement on behalf of the seven Pacific countries at Geneva. Just picking out some of his speech here, you know, he's saying that numerous well-documented reports of extrajudicial executions of activists and the arrests, beatings and fatal shootings of peaceful demonstrators, including high school students, have been noted, as well as reports of persistent violence against women. And Worsall told the session that, you know, there's really been no accountability or justice for any of this stuff. He also mentioned the big problem of the migration of, you know, non-Papuans to West Papua over many decades, you know, leading to a dramatic decline in the percentage of the indigenous population, and basically saying, you know, it's time for the UN Human Rights Council to press the High Commissioner for Human Rights to produce a consolidated report on, quote, the actual situation in West Papua. And remember, these are the same seven Pacific countries whose leaders spoke out so strongly about their concerns about West Papua at the UN General Assembly last September. And that was quite an unprecedented high level of discussion about West Papua. And on that occasion, Indonesia, in its reply, was critical of the Pacific countries for interfering in what Jakarta deems a domestic affair.
Indonesia is often quite sensitive to West Papua being raised in these things. So what's their response been this time around?
A very stern response from Jakarta, categorically rejecting allegations made by the Vanuatu minister on behalf of the Pacific countries. It's produced this statement saying its record on the promotion and protection of rights is, you know, good. It speaks for itself. But it's really gone on the attack against Vanuatu, saying that Vanuatu should not divert attention from its own human rights problems. And I quote from its statement, "The Indonesian government is prepared to work and cooperate with the government of Vanuatu in their efforts to address various human rights violations and abuses against the people of Vanuatu, such as violence against women, corporal punishment against minors, appalling prison conditions, including torture of prisoners and other challenges."
Does Jakarta have a point here?
Well, those things mentioned are issues in Vanuatu. It's maybe not a great comparison, but it's obviously a move to deflect some attention. I mean, in the case of Papua, I guess you'd say you've got an indigenous population who have actively sought help from their Pacific neighbours and their Melanesian kin in these other countries like Vanuatu. I mean, that's clear, as you know, that's been going on for years, that they have embraced and want international help in their bid to have some sort of resolution to the core problems, the core grievance that they have about being part of Indonesia.
And this week there's been more than just representations on West Papua at the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, hasn't there?
Yeah, that's right. The World Council of Churches has also been meeting in Geneva this week, along with an international coalition for Papua made up of churches, NGOs and just people. They're producing renewed calls for Indonesia to open up access more to humanitarian help, NGOs, foreign media journalists to Papua, because they say, you know, that Indonesia is not really helping to address the core grievance that Papuans have. And they're calling for proper independent human rights reportage of the situation in West Papua. So you really got this momentum of international calls for West Papuan human rights advocacy.
A new human rights training program for police in Papua New Guinea emphasizes on responsibilities of police during this year's general election. The United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights contributed to the program, which was launched last week at a police training college in Viamo. The UN Rights Advisor in PNG, Kadar Pudai, told Bren Robinson Drawbridge the training program also focuses on reducing police brutality.
This training module consists of basically six core areas. The first one is about understanding of the human rights generally, also understanding of constitutional and legal provisions in PNG on human rights. Of course, it also involves ethics of police officers when it comes to their operation. And it also covers use of force and use of firearms. Also, of course, human rights during arrest and detention. And when we talk about use of force, one of the areas covered was what are the human rights during the election time. For example, all kind of political rights, right to assembly, to freedom of speech, right to vote. These are some of the political rights police should be aware of, and police have the responsibility to promote those rights. And similarly, handling assemblies and then if there are any rallies during the election time, that was also covered in the training.
So this training will be dispensed to all police in Papua New Guinea prior to the election?
You know, elections are coming closer. It will not be possible to conduct in all provinces, but the training college has plans at least to reach out as much as possible. At least few, maybe 5-6 provinces, they will definitely cover. Even more than that, probably, because, you know, elections will start from April, according to the plan.
Over the years, we have reported issues of domestic violence, sometimes inflicted by members of the police force. So was domestic violence a part of the ethics module?
Yes, of course. This use of force was a main focus of the training program. And facilitator of the program was also from the Ombudsman Commission and focused much on some of the examples of police brutality and then how human rights-based approach to policing can help to reduce this kind of activities. I hope that it will help to change the culture within the police force. But, you know, changing culture takes time, but I'm hopeful that this will change the culture.
Papua New Guinea's opposition party is accusing the government of spending recklessly, and it's warning the country may not be able to host next year's meeting of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC. The party's comments come after the United Nations suspended PNG for failing to pay its annual member fees. PNG's foreign minister, Rimbing Pato, has told the media that it was an administration error and the fees have now been paid. But the deputy leader of PNG's opposition party, Sam Basil, says it's clear the government can no longer afford for even basic services such as power bills. Mr. Basil told the media Langford that it's time for the government to come clean about how much debt it owes.
We understand that currently Papua New Guinea is slipping into financial difficulties in terms of not having the liquidity in our monetary system, because we know that the government has been recklessly spending money in the past few years, and we are now in a situation where the government cannot afford its basic payments of services. Now, it's not only the United Nations fees. We also have problems with our state institutions not being able to have the funding, budgeted funds coming through from the government to pay its bills. Like we have the national parliament that was cut out of power because they cannot afford to pay their power bill. And we all know that the government is struggling to pay many of its bills. And I think they have encroached into the recurrent fundings, which is supposed to be left alone for state institutions to be used to pay for their bills and other services that is rendered to the state.
And it's not looking good, is it, for the country to host APEC?
Well, it's very embarrassing for us, Papua New Guinea, when we know that we will be hosting this very important APEC meeting next year. The way we are going, it doesn't look good, and we are very worried how we will manage ourselves to this to the time when we have the APEC meeting.
What do you think needs to be done now before APEC comes along?
Currently, we do not know how much how deep is the hole of debt that is created by this government? Because the Prime Minister and his Finance Minister are not upfront on how much PNG or how much debt they've created for PNG. We believe that the national elections is coming up and the onus will be with the new government to do stock take and tell publicans how deep is the debt, and we have to put strategies in place to make sure that we recover from where we are. But honestly speaking here, we don't know how much our country owes.
And how worried are you about PNG standing with the UN if it can't pay a simple admin fee?
I think we, from the opposition, one of the opposition members have called out to the for the Foreign Affairs Minister to come clear on the issue. And I think the Prime Minister said it is an administrative issue. But I believe that, it's not only not paying the UN bill, it's many other bills that we are not paying. So I think it all comes back to the mismanagement of the economy, that the Prime Minister is too scared to come out and tell the truth. So all we want is the truth from the Prime Minister, that we have to know what's going on, how much debt are we in, and how long can we manage the economy to bring it back. But there is no recovery measures being announced by the Finance Minister, even the Prime Minister. They are just carrying on from day to day, sucking up whatever funds that is available to meet their obligations, such as the free education and free health and other unnecessary infrastructure being built in Port Moresby.
How bad do you think it might be?
I think it's pretty, pretty bad. I think most of the real scenarios is not really reported, and we're having problems with the two daily newspapers. They are not really reporting what they have to report, and they are not really reporting what the opposition is saying. We've been saying a lot about the economy. We've been saying a lot about the mismanagement, but the press are not running the story. And I believe that most of the press offices in Port Moresby, some of them are on the payroll of ministers. They're taking junket trips around the world. And they have been very compromised in terms of not truly representing a free press reporting of issues affecting Papua New Guinea.
How worried are you about this situation?
We are so worried about the situation. I even stood up in Parliament with a list of things, list of issues against the Prime Minister during the vote of no confidence. That was how worried we were to get rid of the Prime Minister. We did our part. I stood up. I read everything, and unfortunately, a lot of members in government didn't see the reality of what the opposition was talking about, and now we are facing the realities. We are so worried that we do not think the Prime Minister is the fit and proper person to run this country. That's how worried we are.
Last question. The way the country is going now, do you think it will actually be able to host APEC?
If the new government comes into play and the building is already fixed and arrangements are in place, we may not have a choice, but we have to host it. But in the beginning, we say it's not a good idea. And if the Prime Minister would have listened to us, we would have saved some money, because to save some money to look after the economy. But I think if we go past the halfway line, it would be too late for us to stop it. And
right.
It would be an international embarrassment if we do.
So you reckon it would have been better if the country had said, we're not going to host APEC yet, we're not ready for it?
Well, we all know we are not ready for it. But as I've said, if we commit everything and building is up and everything is on, the country has to just go ahead and do it. But we all know that's a good idea. It's a bad idea, and we shouldn't be hosting it at the first place.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. In celebration of this week's International Women's Day, women around the Pacific are gathering together to stand up for change. The global theme is Be Bold for Change, with many women advocates in the Pacific calling on governments to push for more inclusive and gender equality for women in all sectors. Indira Stewart has more.
In Vanuatu's capital, Port Vila, more than 200 women took part in a march calling on the government to make International Women's Day a public holiday to celebrate women. Jenny Ligo led the committee who organised the march and says the committee is particularly calling on the government to support the inclusion of more women in Parliament.
This morning we marched through the city and we shouted, "Be bold for change, go, go, go." We want to let people know that women have to continue to stand strong, and we have achieved a lot of things, and there are a lot of things yet to achieve.
The call is echoed all throughout the region, whose countries hold some of the lowest levels of representation for women in parliament around the world. In celebration of the Global Day, women in Tonga are gathering together to draft a roadmap to help increase women's representation in parliament. Women's advocate Ofa Gutenbeul-Likiliki says the roadmap will be presented to the Prime Minister's office on Friday.
From the last general elections in 2014, although we had the largest number of women female candidates standing, no woman got in. Fortunately enough, in the by-election that we held last year, we now have one woman in Parliament from Ovao. But again, in saying that, we feel like we're going to continue the same pattern if we don't do any particular measures to increase the representation of women in Parliament.
Women across the region are also calling for change in other areas such as gender-based violence and equality in land rights. In many parts of the Pacific, only males are entitled to own land. The region has some of the world's highest rates of violence against women and girls. For example, studies in Fiji show that 64% of women who have ever been in a relationship have experienced physical or sexual violence from a partner. In Kiribati, that number is 68%. Nicholas Bernier, the deputy representative at the Pacific Office for UN Women, says the Pacific is a very difficult place to be a woman.
Women of the Pacific are strong, they carry the countries and their islands on their shoulders, but it's still a very hard place to be a woman. From the fact that the region has some of the highest rates of violence against women in the world, it has some of the lowest levels of representation in parliament for women in the world, and of course women are much less likely to be formally employed by men.
Ms. Gutenbeul-Likiliki says policy alone is not enough to affect change. She believes change needs to start in the classroom and in local community groups, helping to change the mindsets of the next generation.
Have stories and textbooks that children read that promote gender equality. If you're not experiencing it at home, at least they're learning about it in the classroom. Also, healthy and respectful relationships. You know, these programs can be run by the churches at different levels, at different stages of children's development and young people's development. We can start influencing and changing attitudes and behaviour towards women and men.
To mark the Global Day this year, the United Nations has chosen the theme Women's Economic Empowerment in the Changing World of Work. Mr. Burnett says it's important for Pacific governments to recognise the valuable contributions made by women to their economies.
About 75% across the region of market vendors are women. They make a massive contribution to the economy of the region, whether it's because they pay their market fees, that really is one of the main sources of income for municipal councils where you have markets, but they feed the population. Food security, their contribution is invaluable. And often these women market vendors are actually the only bread earner of their family when they come from remote communities.
In 2012, leaders at the Pacific Islands Forum made a declaration to focus on gender equality and to help lift the status of women in the Pacific. Mr. Bernier says while there's been slow progress since the declaration, there's still a long way to go. This is Indira Stewart.
Studies are to be launched this year in several Pacific Island countries into the economic costs of domestic violence. The project was launched on March the 8th by the Commonwealth to reduce domestic violence and empower vulnerable people in its member countries. The Commonwealth Secretary General Patricia Scotland told Sally Round, ending domestic violence is the ultimate goal of the Peace in the Home initiative, and it's achievable.
Challenging domestic violence, looking together at the strategies that work and indeed the strategies that don't, and sharing that information will be a really important start for this initiative. We're also looking at how we can map the economic cost of domestic violence in all of our countries. We know that in the United Kingdom, when it was mapped back in 2003-2004, they found that it cost domestic violence, cost the United Kingdom more than £23 billion a year. We also know that by working together in a multi-agency, multidisciplinary type of way, that the United Kingdom was able to reduce domestic violence by 64% and reduce the cost of domestic violence by £7.1 billion a year. Now, If that can be done in one country, because unfortunately domestic violence is no respecter of people or regions or religions or even gender, then it's possible that we could do that in all of our countries.
So in each individual country, an investigation is going to be launched into the economic cost? Is that what you're planning? I mean, how would you go about this?
In the United Kingdom, we asked Lancaster University to engage with us in trying to identify the cost. So we're looking at our universities. What are they already doing? How can we can collaborate? We've been looking at how we can collaborate with the World Health Organization. We spoke to the World Bank and others to say, how could they enhance the assessment that they've been making in relation to the economic cost of domestic violence so that we have a genuine platform? So it's not just by the Commonwealth and the Commonwealth countries working on their own. It's how can we create effective partnerships with those who are already doing that work, both in our countries and outside our countries, and bind together so that we have the data sets which will enable us to really make the right choices to attack this terrible, pernicious problem of domestic violence in a way that will make it effective, to challenge it and to change it.
What other specific measures? I know that you're going to be unveiling some.
We're working on extending the work that we've already started on strengthening the laws. You'll remember when we were in Samoa, we were looking at how to protect vulnerable women and girls, and we launched our judicial bench book, which defines what constitutes violence against women. That was piloted in East Africa, where the judges described it as an essential tool for delivering gender justice. And we hope we are able to do exactly the same thing in terms of the other regions too. So we're looking at a bench book for the Caribbean, a bench book for Asia, a bench book for the Pacific to help each of our areas in order to make that difference real. And we're looking at making a practical assessment of whether any of us have cultural practices that we can change. We're working with traditional leaders and speaking to them, and we're challenging discrimination and addressing some of those dangerous stereotypes which lead to inequality. So, for example, working in partnership with people in the African Union, in, for example, Zambia, Malawi, and Ghana, we were looking at how we could prevent and eliminate child marriage and creating a series of toolkits to assist governments to adopt the multi-agency approach so that we can give really practical assistance.
And in the Pacific Islands in particular, are there any special toolkits that you have in mind for the Pacific?
First thing to say is the terrible thing about domestic violence, and therefore the good thing about it, is regrettably it manifests itself in a very similar way in all our countries. So the things that we are finding work in one of our countries tend to work in a number. So we're looking at how we review the laws, making sure that the laws are actually as robust as they can be, sharing best practice, sharing the framework agreements and the framework legislation and updating that. We are looking at multi-sector policy guides for Commonwealth health ministers at the next summit in May, and we're working in collaboration with Public Health Wales, looking into the causes and health impacts of domestic violence and the benefits of early intervention. And all of that, as you know, is just as important in the Pacific as in Africa or Asia or Europe, or indeed the Caribbean and North America.
The aim is to end domestic violence. Do you think that's really achievable?
I think it is, but it's going to take all of us. You know, it's not something that governments can do on their own, or local governments can do on their own, or third sector charities can do on their own, or business can do on their own. We know that because we've all worked extremely hard in the past to do it in our silos, on our own, and it hasn't worked as well as it could do. We found in the United Kingdom when we had this multi-dimensional, multi-agency approach, it works. It saves us money and it saves us lives. So I think we have a real chance at doing this.
The Samoan government says it'll review its policy on monetary rewards for Olympic medalists following public pressure to recognize Ile Ogi's historic achievement. The weightlifter won Samoa's first Olympic medal at the 2008 Games in Beijing after being upgraded to silver when two competitors were disqualified for drugs. The prime minister said last month the government's policy was to only offer rewards for gold medal winners, but the sports minister, Liu Kentidi Sio, told Vinnie Wiley changes are possible.
The cabinet by that particular time didn't have in mind the difference of the games. But in the way that we are looking at putting a paper cane and revisit that policy, whether we can put in place the ranking of the games so that we can have an idea which particular game and which medal that we're supposed to be rewarded with to the athletes. If we can revisit that again, then that will be good solutions to come out with that situation.
So are you saying that the government will revisit that? I mean, it's up to the government, which obviously you're a part of, to make that decision as to whether you want to relook at it.
I am looking forward to putting up a paper again. It's from the sports perspective. So I guess that yes, and I am looking into that. Hopefully that will be in the near future.
As the Minister for Sports in Samoa, what is your reaction to the overwhelming public support for Aliopi Longa's achievement and wanting her to be recognised? Is that something that you've noticed? Is that something that you are very aware of?
I guess that, with the situation, particularly with Ali, yes, it has been noticed. And I can see that people are overwhelming and hopefully that they can help, which is I have. As I said, that I have nothing to go against with. I have also pledged as well, in a way, so that, But no, the government doesn't have anything to do with it in a way of their fundraising to have some fun for it.
What does that mean for you as the Minister of Sport, you know, on behalf of the country, to have an Olympic medalist in Samoa and what that might mean for future generations that will look up to her and do look up to her already?
I guess this is one of the best times that we're receiving a medal, especially the Olympic Games. And it's a great achievement that we've got, and I'm so thrilled and proud of what Ile has been done for our country in a way of getting this medal. And hopefully that I can see that the government is for sure that they'll be playing a part on that ceremony in the way of receiving the medal.
Yeah, and I guess it's that achievement that which is why there's been such a strong sort of groundswell of support for people wanting to see her recognised further.
Yeah, I guess so.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.